Chapter 18. KCX 1288 by the light of the quill star. Into the wound. The wrongness. On the first day of the 31st week, just under a day outside Maxilla's estimate, the SN burst back into real space, deep inside the system designated KCX 1288. Almost at once we were in danger. The local star was a vast, swollen fireball, pulsing and retching out its last few million years of life. Distended and no longer spherical, it glowed with a malevolent pink fire beneath a cooling crust of black shreds and tatters that looked like rot infecting its granular skin. Firestorms swirled and blistered across its enlarged surface and vomited gouts of stellar matter out into the system. An immense column of excreting gas and matter plumed away from the behemoth star, almost a light year long. It looked like a huge, luminous quill stabbed into the soft ball of that sun. From the moment of our arrival at the translation point, sirens and alarms began shrilling on the bridge. External radiation levels were almost immeasurable, and we shuddered and rocked through waves of searing star debris. The entire system was lousy with drifting radioactive banks, ash clouds, flares, and the splinters of matter they projected, and magnetic anomalies. Our shields were full on, and already we were taking damage. Maxilla said nothing, but furrowed his brow in concentration as he steered the juddering ship in through the treacherous course, negotiating the gravity pools and radioactive undertows. "It's falling apart," said Amos, awed, gazing at the main projection screen and the furiously scrolling bars of data that flickered across it. "The whole damn system is in a state of collapse." "Any sign of them?" I called to Maxilla.
"We must be right on their tail. They were half a day ahead of us, no more. Damn this interference. Wait."
"What?" He said something I couldn't hear over the cacophony. "Say again." Maxilla cancelled the screaming sirens. The juddering and shaking continued, and now we could hear the groaning and creaking of the SN's hull under stress. He pointed to the picked plate that overviewed the SN's sensor operations.
"I'm picking up their drive wake and gravitational displacement, but in these conditions it's getting really hard to read them with accuracy. There."
He tapped a glove finger on the plate.
"That's undoubtedly a drive wake. But how do you explain it?"
I shook my head. I'm no mariner.
"They've split," said Midas, looking over our shoulders. "The main portion has fallen back, maybe out of the system itself to a safe distance, and a smaller core group has continued on in. Maybe five ships, six at most."
"That's how I read it too," Maxilla agreed. "A fleet division. I'd guess they didn't want to risk sending their biggest ships into this maelstrom."
"I can see why," murmured Beckwin, gazing at the seething turmoil on the main display.
"Forget about the ones that have withdrawn. Follow the lead group in," I said.
"I would advise," Maxilla began.
"Do it."
With the aid of his navigational servitors, he adjusted the SN's trajectory and set on after the drive wake of the smaller group, driving in system.
There, look,"
Maxilla called out suddenly, adjusting a secondary display unit to magnify and enhance an image. It was distant, but we could see the burst open hulk of an Imperial cruiser drifting in a halo of slowly dissipating energy.
"Definitely one of Estrom's ships, hulled by meteor storms. They ran into trouble the moment they pressed on."
The SN shook again.
"What about us?" I asked.
Maxilla conferred with Betancourt. There was a particularly violent shudder and the main lights went out for a second.
"We need shelter," Maxilla told me frankly.
As far as the SN's bewildered and overtaxed sensors could establish, there were 15 planets in the system, as well as millions of planetoid fragments, mostly ragged embers of wasted rock and venting energy. Our quarry's drive wake led directly to the third largest, one of the inner worlds. It was a scabby, ruined, semi-shattered ball with lingering swathes of swirling bluish atmosphere. Craters covered its northern hemisphere. Some impacts had been so large that they had torn open the mantle and exposed the livid red core beneath, like a skull cracked with devastating wounds. Even as we watched, we saw scatters of light dot and blossom across the surface as meteors struck and incinerated continents far below. We tore in through the convulsing fabric of space, past moons of blood and striated mackerel clouds of dust. A vast sheet of stellar fire swept out at us, throwing the ship wildly off course and hurling silver lumps of rock and ice against our shields.
"Madness!" cried Fischig. "They wouldn't have come here. It's death!"
Maxilla looked at me, as if hoping I'd agree with the chastener and call us off for the sake of the SN.
"You are sure of their traces?"
Maxilla, his hands flexing on the controls, swallowed and nodded.
"Get us down there, into whatever shelter the planet's bulk can give us. At least let's confirm their corpses before we leave."
Descent took 20 minutes. None of them smooth and none of them guaranteeing a sequel. I wanted to use the time to get Loink or Maxilla's astropaths to check on the approach of the task force from Gudrun that had set out, on my instructions 30 weeks ago, to rendezvous with us here. But it was impossible. The stellar distortion rendered astrotelepathy blind. I cursed. We went in steeply, down towards the dark side of the wounded planet. Blooms of fire consumed crater-pocked landmasses in the darkness below, and ammoniacal storms raged in oceanic measures. Even here, with the planet between us and the convulsing sun, the ride was hard and rough. We saw, for a second, as we passed, another ship ruin, another of Estrom's fleet, splintered and destroyed. A death world. A death system.
"Our enemies must have made a mistake," said Amos,
holding on to the edge of a console to steady himself.
"The Saruthi can't be here. If they ever inhabited this system, they must have long since abandoned it."
"Yet," I countered, "the heretic fleet's advance group presses on with great determination and purpose." The SN continued to descend, closer than it would normally come to a planetary body. Only ribbons of atmosphere remained, and Maxilla clung to the ragged surface, passing barely 10 kilometers above the bare rock. Drizzles of shooting stars rained past us.
"What's that?" I asked.
Maxilla adjusted his sensors and the resolution of the display. A huge wound in the planet's crust yawned before us, 1,000 kilometers wide, a cliff-like lip of impact-raised rock with a vast cavity beneath.
"The sensors can't resolve it. Is that meteor damage?"
"Perhaps from an angled strike," said Amos.
"Did they go past or in?" I asked.
"In?"
barked Maxilla, incredulously.
"In! Did they go in?"
Amos was leaning over the servitor at the sensor station.
"The drive wake ebbs and disappears here. Either they were vaporized en masse at this point, or they indeed went inside."
I looked at Maxilla. The SN bucked again, thrown by a gravity pool, and the bridge lights went out briefly for a second time.
"This is a star-going ship," he said softly. "Not built for surface landing."
"I know that," I replied. "But neither were theirs. They have more information than we do, and they have gone inside."
Shaking his head, Maxilla turned the SN down towards the vast wound. The rift cavity was dark and limitless according to the sensors, though in my opinion the sensors were no better than useless now. A dull red glow suffused the darkness far below us. The violent shaking had stopped, but still the hull creaked and protested at the gravitational stress. We had the sudden impression of moving through some structure, then another, then a third. The display revealed the fourth before we passed under it, an angular hoop or arch 80 kilometers across. Beyond it, more in the series, towering around us as we progressed, as if we were passing down the middle of a giant ribcage.
"They're octagonal," said Amos.
"And irregular," I added.
No two of the rib arches were the same, but they displayed the same form and lack of symmetry as their companions, the shape we now instantly associated with the Saruthi.
"These can't be natural," said Maxilla.
We continued in under the cyclopean spans, passing through a dozen, then a dozen more. "Light sources ahead," a servitor announced. A dull greenish glow fogged into being far away down the avenue of octagonal arches.
"Do we continue?"
asked Maxilla. I nodded. "Send a marker drone back to the surface." A moment later, the rear display showed a small servitor drone struggling back up the vast channel towards the surface, running lights winking. We ran on past the last arch. There was another judder. Then we were riding clear into light, smooth, pale green light. There seemed to be no roof or ceiling to whatever we were in, though inside the planetary cavity we undoubtedly were. Just hazy green light, and below, a carpet of wispy cloud. All turbulence stopped. We were like a ship becalmed. The atmosphere in this place, logic battled to make us remember we were inside the crust of a planet, was thin and inert, a vaguely ammoniacal vapour. None of us could explain the source of the pervasive luminescence or the fact that the SN sat comfortably at grav anchor in the serene quiet. As Maxilla had pointed out, it was not a trans-atmospheric vessel, and it should have been impossible to stabilize it this close to a planetary body without severe stress damage. From its system registers, the SN seemed happy enough, happy to have ridden out the vile stellar storms of KCX-1288 into this safe harbor. Apart from minor impact damage, only two of the ship's systems were inoperative. The sensors were blind and giving back nothing but odd, dead echoes. And every chronometer on the ship had stopped, except two that were running backwards. Betancourt and Maxilla studied the imperfect returns of the sensor arrays and concluded land of some sort lay beneath us, under the cloud bank. We estimated that it was 6 kilometers straight down, though in this vague, hazy rift it was difficult to say. If Glor's heretics were here, they had left no trace. But with our sensors so badly occluded, their advanced fleet could be anchored just on the other side of the clouds. We dropped to the cloud bank from the SN in the gun cutter shortly afterwards. All of us had buckled on hard armor vacuum suits from Maxilla's lockers. Loink, Fischig, Amos and I shambled about the crew bay, getting used to the heavy plate and bulky quilting of the suits. Beckwin was in the cockpit with Betancourt, watching him take us down. The pair of them wore borrowed vacuum suits too, and she was pinning up her hair so it would not interfere with the helmet seal.
"Good hunting, Inquisitor," crackled Maxilla from the SN above us.
"He'll be down there, won't he?"
asked Beckwin, and I knew she was referring to Mandragore. "It's likely. Him. And whatever this is all about."
"Well, you heard what Pontius said," she replied.
How could I not have? The Necrochuke. One doesn't hear a word like that and forget it. It had taken her weeks to gain the confidence of our bodiless prisoner, to play the part of a disaffected traitor. I hadn't been sure she was up to it, but she had performed with patience and a finely gauged measure of play-acting. It had been a risk, letting her slip in to see Pontius alone. She had assured me she could do it, and she had not been wrong. The Necrochuke. If Pontius Glor was telling the truth, our enterprise had even greater urgency now. I had wondered what could be so precious, so important, as to galvanize our enemies so, make them risk so much. I had my answer. Legend said the last extant copy of that abominable work had been destroyed millennia before. Except that by some means, in antique ages past, a copy had come into the hands of the Zaruthi race. And now they were preparing to trade it back to Glor's imperial heretics. We came down through the clouds and saw the land below, a wide, rolling expanse of dust sweeping down to what seemed to be a sea. Liquid frothed and broke along a curved shoreline 100 kilometers long. Everything was a shade of pale green, bathed by the radiance that glowed through the wispy clouds. There was a misty softness to it all, a lack of sharp focus. It seemed endless, toneless, slow. There was a calm, ethereal feel that was at once soothing and unnerving. Even the lapping sea seemed languid. It reminded me of the seacoast at Trelito, on Calan II, where I had spent a summer recuperating from injuries years before. Endless leagues of mica dunes, the slow sea, the balmy, hazy air.
"How big?" I asked Midas.
"Is what?"
he asked.
"This place."
He pointed to the instruments.
"Can't say. 100 kilometers? 2? 3? 1,000?
You must have something."
He looked round at me with a smile that had worry in it.
"Systems say it's endless, which is, of course, impossible. So I think the instruments are out. I'm not trusting them anyway."
"Then what are you flying by?"
"My eye, or the seat of my pants, whichever you find most reassuring."
We followed the slow curve of the endless bay for about 10 minutes. At last, details emerged to break up the uniform anonymity. A row of arches, octagonal, jutting from the sand a few 100 meters back from the waterline, ran parallel to the water. They were each about 50 meters broad, in everything but scale, the twins of the arches Maxilla had guided the SN through. They extended away as far as we could see in the green haze.
"Set us down."
We sat the guncutter on the soft, dusty sand, half a kilometre from the shore, clamped on our helmets and ventured out. The radiance was greater than I had expected. The cutter's ports had been tinted, and we slid down brown glass overvisors against the glare. I hate vacuum suits. The sense of being muffled and constrained, the ponderous movement, the sound of my own breath in my ears, the sporadic click of the intercom. The suit shut out all sounds from outside, except the crunch of my feet on the fine, dry sand. We shuffled down to the water's edge in a wide file. All of us, except Amos, carried weapons. It looked like a sea. Green water showing white at the breakers.
"Liquid ammonia," Amos said, his voice a low crackle over the vox.
There was something strange about it.
"Do you see it?"
he asked me.
"What?" "The waves are moving out from the shore."
I looked again. It was so obvious I had missed it. The liquid wasn't rushing in and breaking. It was sucking away from the shore and rolling back into itself. It was chilling. So simple. So wrong. My confidence withered. I wanted to strip off the claustrophobic suit and cry out. And I would have, except for the stark red warning lights and the atmosphere reader built into my suit's bulky left cuff. What was it Maxilla had said? The Ceruthi had tormented the men of the Promethean. I didn't know for a moment if the unnatural behaviour of the sea was their doing. How could it have been? But I understood how insidious, distressing torment might have played upon them. Fischig and Betancourt had approached the first of the arches. I looked across and saw them dwarfed by the unsymmetrical structure. The next in the line was 300 meters away, and they seemed regularly spaced. Each one, as far as I could see, was irregular in a different way, though the size and proportions were identical. Beckwin was kneeling on the shoreline, brushing the sand aside gently with her gauntlet. She had found what was perhaps the most distressing detail so far. Under the sand, a few centimetres down, the ground was tiled. Tessellated, irregular octagonal tiles, just like the ones she had found on the floor of the mine working at North Quam. Once more, they fitted perfectly, impossibly, despite their shape. The more of them she uncovered, the more she brushed the sand away. "Stop it," I said. "For our sanity, I don't think it's worth trying to discover if they cover the entire beach."
"Can all of this be artificial?" she asked.
"It can't be," said Amos. "Perhaps the tiles and the arches are part of some old structure, long abandoned, that has since been flooded and covered with the dust, due to...
He didn't sound at all convincing. I crossed to Fischig and Betancourt and stood with them, gazing up at the first arch. It was wrought from that odd, unknown metal we had seen on Damask.
"What do we do now?"
Fischig asked.
"Well, I hate to state the obvious," said Amos from down the beach, "but the last row of these we found formed a deliberate pathway that led the SN in here. Should we assume this serves the same purpose?"
I stepped forward through the broad, towering shape of the first arch. "Come on," I said. We walked for what I estimated was perhaps 20 minutes. Estimated. All of our chronometers were dead. After the first few minutes, we began to hear a distant, repetitive boom. A low, almost subsonic peal like thunder that rolled out from somewhere far away over the sea. Or seemed to. It came every half minute or so. There were long intervals of silence, and just when we'd thought we'd heard the last, another boom would come. Like the crunch of our own footsteps, we could hear it through the suits, even with our vox circuits switched off. I voxed to Maxilla. "Can you hear that?" There was a crackle and no immediate reply. Then a sudden burst of transmission. Maxilla's voice.
"As you instruct, Gregor, but it's not going to be easy. Say again. What did you say about Fischig?"
"Maxilla, repeat," I began.
But his voice continued over the top, incoherent. It wasn't a reply. I was just picking up his voice. I felt my spine go cold. More static.
"Tell Elizabeth I agree with that. Ha!"
It went dead. I looked back at the others. Their pale faces gazed out of the tinted brown faceplates like ghosts.
"What was that?" I murmured.
"An echo," Amos whispered. "Some kind of transmission anomaly caused by the atmosphere and the..."
"It's not a conversation I've ever had."
Another boom of thunder rolled across the dry, softly lit shore. After my estimated 20 minutes, we passed through what was suddenly the last arch. We all stopped. Ahead of us, the land rose more steeply into hills and low ridges. The terrain there was darker, inhospitable. The overall radiance had dulled, and the sky was a deep green, oozing into blackness over the hills.
There were more in the row, Fischig exclaimed. More arches!
He was right. The octagonal colonnade had disappeared as we passed through the last arch. I stepped back through, imagining perhaps that from the other side the arches might reappear. They didn't. The booming continued. We set off towards the hills. Bursts of static hissed through our vox units.
Transmissions, said Loink.
He fiddled with his vox channels.
I can't tune them in, but their chatter. Military, back and forth.
Our quarry, perhaps.
Look, said Betancourt, pointing behind us. Beyond the shore and the retreating line of arches, three ominous dark shapes hung under the clouds, out over the sea.
Two imperial frigates and an old, non-standard merchantman, floating at grav anchor.
How did we not see them when we passed?
I don't know, Midas. I'm not sure of anything anymore. When I turned back to the rest of the group, I saw Amos unclasping his helmet. Amos!
Calm yourself, he said, uncovering his wizened old head.
With the wide locking collar of the suit around him, he looked like a tortoise, pushing its gnarled head from its shell. He raised his left arm and showed me the atmosphere reader. The lights were green.
Human perfect atmosphere, he said. A little cold and sterile, but human perfect.
We all unclasped our helmets and pulled them off. The chilly air bit my face, but it was good to be free of the suits. There was no scent to the air, none at all. Not salt or ammonia or dust. We helped each other fasten our helmets to our shoulder packs. The booming was duller and more distant now. It didn't have our hollow helmets to resonate through. We could hear each other's footsteps, each other's breathing, the suck and lap of the ocean. I could suddenly smell Bequin's perfume. It was reassuring. I led the group on, and we climbed slowly into the rising land. Now free of the helmet, I understood our ponderous progress was a result of more than our heavy suits. It was somehow difficult to gauge distance and depth. We stumbled every now and then. The whole place was profoundly wrong. We came upon them very suddenly. The sudden resumption of the vox traffic was our only warning. Our speakers burst into life simultaneously.
Run! Move up! Segment two! Where are you? Where are you? Cover to the left! That's an order! Cover to the left! They're behind me! They're behind me and I ca—
A fierce hiss of static. Ahead, coming down the ridges and slopes of the dark rise, we saw soldiers, Imperial Guard, wearing red and gold combat armor. Gudrunite riflemen.
Cover!
I ordered, and we dropped down into the shelter of the rising dunes, readying weapons. There were 60 or more of them, hurrying down the upper slopes towards us in a wide straggle, running. There was no order to it. They were fleeing. An officer in their midst was waving his arms and shouting, but they were ignoring him. Many had lost helmets or rifles. A second later, their pursuers came over the rise and fell upon them from behind. Three black armored speeders in the livery of Navy security and a following line of 30 troopers in their distinctive black armor, ordered, disciplined, marching in a spaced line, firing their hell guns into the backs of the fleeing conscripts. The land speeders swept in low, drizzling the slopes with cannon fire. The shots threw up plumes of dust and the mangled bodies of men. A second later, and all three land speeders passed over us at what seemed like head height, overshooting across the ammonia sea and banking round to follow in on another pass. Some of the Gudrunites were firing back, and I saw one trooper topple and fall, but there was no coordination, no control.
What the hell? Do we stay hidden?
Gasped Bequin.
They'll see us soon enough, said Fischig,
sliding open the feed slit of his heavy Stubbers box magazine. The odds were terrible, and ever since the incident on the SN, I'd had a morbid loathing of the black-clad troopers. But still. I pulled out my heavy auto-pistol and tossed it to Amos, freeing my las carbine from the fastener lugs on my pack. Bequin drew her own weapons, a pair of las pistols. Loink and Midas had their firearms, a las carbine and a Glavian needle rifle, respectively, already braced in their hands.
Look to the troops, I told Fischig, Loink, and Bequin. Do what you can, Amos. Midas, the flyers are down to us.
We bellied forward through the dunes, and then came up firing. Fischig's big gun smashed into the lip of the high ridge, kicking up dust, before he found range and demolished three of the stalking troopers. Lowing's carbine cracked out, and Amos fired the auto-pistol hesitantly. Beckwin was amazing. She'd used her time well during the 30-week passage, and Midas had clearly instructed her carefully. A las pistol in each hand, she whooped out a battle cry of sorts and placed careful shots that dropped two more of the troopers. The troopers balked in their ruthless advance, realizing the situation had suddenly changed. The scattering Gudrunites also wavered, and some of them, the officer included, turned and began to confront the killers. I had been counting on this. We couldn't take them alone. I had trusted that our sudden intervention might galvanize the guardsmen. Still, many ran. A fierce firefight erupted along the ridge between the halted troopers and those Gudrunites below who were turning to fight. Lowing, Fischig, Amos, and Beckwin moved forward in support. The landspeeders swept back, hammering the shore with shells. Betancourt dropped to one knee, raised his exotic weapon, and fired. The long barrel pulsed and made a sound like a whispered shriek. Explosive splinters tore through the nearest speeder as it crossed down over us, and it blew apart in the air. Burning wreckage scattered across the sand. I chased a second with my carbine. It was turning to present on us, and the turn made it slow. My shots missed or deflected from the armor. As its heavy cannon began to fire, pulverizing the sand in a stitching row towards me, I shot the pilot through the faceplate. Still firing, it plunged suddenly and hit the beach 50 meters behind me. It bounced, shredding apart, struck again and crashed into the breakers in a spray of debris that threw up thousands of mismatched splashes. The third speeder turned in and made another pass, killing 6 more of the fleeing Gudrunites, who presented easy targets on the sand. Midas had his weapon trained on it and fired as it passed over, missing. He fired again, striking its rear end as it burned away. It kept going, over the beach, out to sea. I have no idea what he hit, the crew, the control systems, but it just kept going, on and on, until it disappeared from sight. We pressed up the slope, in among the Gudrunites now. They were dirty and disheveled to a man, none older than 25. Seeing us and the damage we had wrought, they cheered, perhaps imagining we were part of some greater rescue force. On the upper ridge, the last few troopers were crumpling. Fischig charged them, his stubber wailing, and a dozen Gudrunites went with him, eager to turn on their tormentors. The ridge fight lasted another 2 minutes. Fischig lost 2 of the Gudrunites with him, but made certain none of the troopers survived. Law enforcement, I remember thinking, had robbed the military of a fine soldier in Chasiner Fischig. I sought out the Gudrunite officer as his men collapsed, weary with exhaustion and relief. Some were weeping. All of them looked scared. Smoke from the battle drifted down the ridge in the windless air. The officer, a sergeant, was no older than his men. He had attempted to grow a beard, but his facial hair wasn't really up to it. He saluted me even before I had shown him my badge of office. Then he fell on his knees. "Get up," he did. "Inquisitor Eisenhorn. And you are?"
"Sergeant Enil Jerus, 2nd Battalion, 50th Gudrunite Rifles. Sir, is the fleet here?"
I held out my hand to quieten him down. "Appraise me, quickly and briefly."
"We wanted no part of it. We were mustered to the frigate Exalted, waiting to ship out. When we ran from Gudrun High Anchor, the captain told us all Gudrun had fallen and we were relocating."
"The captain?"
"Captain Estrom, sir."
"And then?"
30 weeks in transit to get here. The moment we arrived, we knew something was wrong. We protested, demanded to know what was happening. They called it dereliction and sent dozens to the firing squads. We were given a chance to follow orders or die."
"Not much of a chance." He shook his head.
"No, sir. That's why I tried to get the men out. We broke and ran, once we'd got in there, once they were busy. They came after us to hunt us down."
"In where?" He gestured back over the ridge.
"The darkness."
"Tell me what you saw," I said.